Welcome to The End of Innocence. I'm your host, John Young. In the last 2 weeks, I've been bombarded with emails about an article that was published on July 25th by Rich Lowry in the National Review. The article was titled, quote, "Sorry, Everyone, Oswald Still Acted Alone," end quote. It was basically the same old with a member of the national media when it comes to the Kennedy assassination. The article was pro-Warren Commission and very one-sided. It pretty much ignored all evidence that didn't toe the company line and agree with the Warren Commission's findings. It seems Lowry got his information from Warren Report supporter and media darling, Gerald Posner. So like any good JFK assassination researcher, I wanted to go through exactly what Rich Lowry said in his article and provide legitimate counterpoints that make the picture much cloudier than Lowry leads his readers to believe. Lowry starts his article out by basically talking about some people in the national spotlight and how they're talking about the JFK assassination was done by the CIA. Specifically, he mentions Sean Davis of The Federalist, who's talking about the Trump assassination attempt. Davis basically says that the CIA killed JFK and RFK, and they tried to do the same to Donald Trump. And then there's Donald Trump Jr., saying the same thing. In a recent conversation with Donald Trump Jr., Tucker Carlson casually referred to the system having been broken, quote, for the last 61 years since they killed a president in an election year, end quote. Trump Jr. responded, quote, exactly. Then you got Ron Paul saying that the JFK assassination was a coup. And he says, quote, I don't think it's a controversial statement anymore to say that the CIA, especially former director Alan Dulles, was involved in the assassination of John Kennedy, end quote. Lowry also mentions in his article Rob Reiner's podcast titled Who Killed JFK? His show had over 1 million hits in less than a month. For those in the public arena and say that the CIA was involved in Kennedy's assassination, all I have to say, you better do your homework. But I will say this, there is a lot out there in my research that tells me that some high-ranking officials of the CIA were involved, and definitely some rogue elements of the CIA were certainly involved in the planning and possibly the execution of JFK's murder. I have went on the record stating that I don't think the attempted assassination of Donald Trump was a conspiracy, but just incompetence by the Secret Service and maybe some looking the other way. When it comes to the comparison of the JFK assassination to the Trump attempted assassination, here's how you can tell that one was a setup and one was not. 10 minutes after Kennedy was shot, the police, the FBI, and the Secret Service knew exactly who they were looking for, Lee Harvey Oswald. They knew his description, where he worked, and apparently where he was going. In the shooting of Trump, it has taken weeks for them to find out information about Thomas Crooks, and they still have no idea of a motive, and information has been scarce. Like I said, one was a planned setup, and one was not. On this podcast, we have covered most of the primary evidence in Kennedy's assassination, and in my book, The End of Innocence, it is covered in much more detail. We have explored a lot of Lee Harvey Oswald's life that points to him being involved in U.S. intelligence in some form or fashion. And it's certainly possible that the CIA is a candidate for who could have been behind the assassination. But the implications of that are so grave that I think it's necessary to expect people who are in the public arena to be able to back up their conclusions on the case. Now back to the article. Mr. Lowry starts his article off stating, quote, the JFK conspiracy theories originally emanated from the left. As the right has come to hate and distrust the deep state, though, the theories have seeped over. That such conspiracy theories have so long endured and, in fact, found new converts on another part of the political spectrum is a stunning victory of paranoia over reason and fiction over fact. For all of its consequences, the JFK assassination is an uncomplicated murder case, end quote. Lowry goes on to say, quote, the simplicity of the case is inversely related to the complex mental gymnastics necessary to implicate anyone other than Lee Harvey Oswald. There's a reason that the Dallas police almost instantly solved the case. He continues, it doesn't matter to the conspiracy theorists that, despite all the effort devoted to the attempt, they've come up with no evidence for their claims, while they reject the massive evidence pointing to Oswald acting alone. They recycle the same old misunderstandings of the facts, not knowing or caring that they've been debunked long ago, end quote. Mr. Lowry says that he relies solely on Gerald Posner's book, Case Closed, and Vincent Bugliosi's book, Reclaiming History. Both men are media darlings, and of course, they back the Warren Commission and their findings. Those books are important ones to have if you want to have a full picture of the case and know what all the arguments are, including all the Warren Report defense arguments. These books, though, take a very clear position. In other words, they side with the Warren Commission. But the problem is they leave out a lot of important evidence. So today, we're going to go through Larry's article and talk about issues he raises that are not factually supported. So here we go, you better buckle up. Larry says that almost all of the witnesses thought that the shots came from the Texas School Book Depository, but that's not actually true. Vincent Bugliosi is one of the authors that Larry's relying upon, and Bugliosi himself says that of the 88 witnesses who expressed an opinion on where the shots came from, 40 said the grassy knoll, and 41 said the Texas School Book Depository. 7 said the shots came from somewhere else. So that's 40 for the grassy knoll, and 41 for the School Book Depository. So that's close to a 50-50 split. Not almost all, as Larry states in his article. The next thing that Larry says is multiple witnesses saw a man with a rifle in the 6th floor window. That is a true statement. But when we unpack the details behind that, you will see that it really doesn't mean that Oswald's guilty, just because multiple witnesses saw a man with a rifle on the 6th floor or in the 6th floor window. All of this information I'm sharing with you is readily available and easy accessible nowadays. It wasn't back before the days of the internet. You had to do old school digging, and that's exactly what I did. So Howard Brennan was a star witness for the Warren Commission, and he is sitting on a concrete pedestal wall across the street from the Texas School Book Depository. He says that he looks up to the 6th floor window and sees Oswald, according to the Warren Report. He's looking across the street and up 6 stories. But on the night of the assassination, Howard Brennan was given the opportunity to identify Oswald at the police station, and he said that it didn't look like the man that he saw, and he could not confirm that it was Lee Harvey Oswald that he had seen earlier in the window of the 6th floor.
I noticed this one man on the 6th floor of the Texas bookstore. Well, he left the window a couple of times in the course of 7, 8, or 10 minutes. I looked directly across and up, possibility of a 45-degree angle. And this man, same man I had saw prior to the president's arrival, was in the window and taking aim for his last shot. After he fired the last or the third shot, he didn't seem to be in a great rush, hurry. He seemed to pause for a moment to see if for sure he accomplished his purpose, and he brought the gun back to rest in upright position as though he was satisfied. The Secret Service man asked me for a description. I gave him a description of a man in his early 30s, wearing light khaki-colored clothing, height 5'9" or 10", weighing 170 pounds.
If you go to Dealey Plaza and stand where Brennan was, and look up for yourself at that window, and I've done it probably 100 times or more, I think you'll be satisfied that you'd be able to tell if someone had a hat or glasses, and maybe the complexion of their skin. But you wouldn't be able to tell what someone's face looked like from that far away, especially if you had never seen them before. And just for the record that day, Oswald was not wearing khaki-colored clothing. And keep in mind that the description that was sent out on police radios minutes after the assassination came from Howard Brennan's sightings of supposedly Oswald. It gave his height and weight, and there is no way from where Brennan was that he could tell his height or weight. Another potential witness who saw a man with a rifle in the 6th floor window is Amos Ewens. He said that he saw a man with a pipe in a high window, and it was held by a guy with a bald spot on his head. One big problem here, Oswald didn't have a bald spot. Lowry also could potentially be talking about Bob Edwards and Ronald Fisher, who say they saw a white guy in the window from the street, but they didn't identify him as Oswald. Lowry could also be talking about Carolyn Walter, who said she saw a shooter in the window, and she also saw a man standing behind the shooter wearing a brown sports coat.
They said the man was wearing a brown suit, and that was all I could see was half of this man's body.
Of course, if there's a man behind the shooter, then that's 2 people. That's not Oswald alone. Richard Randolph Carr saw a man looking out the top floor of the book depository moments before the shooting. Carr, like Carolyn Walter, said the man was wearing a light brown coat. He described the man as having an athletic build, wearing horn-rimmed glasses and a hat. A few minutes after the assassination, Carr saw the same man walking toward him on Houston Street, constantly looking back over his shoulder. The man turned east on Commerce Street, walked 1 block to Record Street, and got into a 1961 or 1962 light-colored Nash Rambler station wagon. There is a lot of strange things that was happening with that Nash Rambler station wagon. Go back and listen to episode 9 for all the details. I suppose Larry could also be talking about Arnold Roland, who said that he saw a man with dark hair with a rifle on the 6th floor in a window about 12:15, at the same time when Oswald was still on the 2nd floor, according to witness Carolyn Arnold. She saw him there at 12:15 and again at 12:25. This is one part of the scenario that I wish Larry would have covered in more detail with his expertise on the case. The newspapers in Dallas that day printed Kennedy's schedule and said that the motorcade would be passing through Dealey Plaza at 12:25 p.m. The motorcade was running about 5 minutes late because Kennedy took a little extra time to shake hands with well-wishers at Love Field. Any assassin wanting to shoot the president would have been in that 6th-floor window ready to fire away at 12:25, because they would have had no way of knowing the motorcade was running 5 minutes late. So where was Oswald at 12:25? He was in the 2nd-floor lunchroom, seen by Mrs. Arnold. You see, things aren't as cut as dry as Larry would have his readers to believe. Larry also says that the police had an accurate gunman description within minutes, but the gunman's description was a slender white male about 30 years old, 5 feet 10 inches, weighing 165 pounds.
Attention all squads. The suspect in the shooting at Elm in Houston is reported to be an unknown white male, approximately 30, slender build, height 5 feet 10 inches, weight 165 pounds, reported to be armed with what is thought to be a 30 caliber rifle. No further description at this time or information. 1245 KKB 361.
Oswald was actually a little younger, but this description fit him along with thousands of men in and around Dallas. Like I stated earlier, the description came from Howard Brennan, who again was standing across the street pretty far away, looking 6 stories up, and there was no way from where he was standing that he'd be able to tell how tall someone was in that position. So by no means can we say that Brennan reliably identified the gunman within minutes. Lowry goes on to say, quote, "The idea that Oswald couldn't have hit Kennedy or that there were more than 3 shots is based on a series of misconceptions. It is said that Oswald didn't have time to get off the shots, often based on a fallacious reading of the Zapruder film. But the real timing of the shots has been duplicated or improved upon many times in tests," end quote. This is the next thing that I have an issue with. I will say it again. All this information is out there and readily available. With just a little research, Lowry could have known that he was telling his readers an outright lie. The shots have not been recreated many times that Oswald supposedly attempted. The Zapruder film creates a time window for exactly how long the shooter would have had to take those shots. The FBI tried to recreate for the Warren Commission the same shots that Oswald is allegedly to have taken. They had shooters firing at stationary targets from 30 feet up, whereas whoever the shooter was in the 6th-floor window was firing at a moving target from 60 feet up. In the test done for the Warren Commission, 5 of 6 of the world-class riflemen who tried to hit all 3 shots failed to do so in the allotted amount of time. Only 1 of the 6 world-class riflemen succeeded. And by the way, Oswald was not a world-class rifleman. A more accurate experiment was run by CBS News in 1967, where they had 11 professional marksmen try to hit a moving target from 60 feet up, which would more closely resemble what Oswald was supposed to have done. The 11 professionals took 37 attempts at hitting 2 of 3 shots. Out of those 37 attempts, there were only 3 successful attempts. So no, Mr. Lowry, the shots have not been recreated many times, in many tests. And in fact, when shooters, who were by all accounts far better shooters than Oswald, tried to take the same shots or similar shots, they weren't able to. Lowry then states, quote, "It is alleged that it would have been impossible for Oswald to hit Kennedy because he allegedly was a poor shot. The truth is Oswald was a good shot during his stint in the Marine Corps, exceeding the score needed to be a sharpshooter, and he practiced once he procured his rifle," end quote. So let's discuss this point by Mr. Lowry. Again, this information I'm about to tell you is very easy to find on the internet in 2024. We have 2 shooting tests from Oswald's time in the Marines. In 1956, he scored 212 out of 250 to get the sharpshooter rating, just like Lowry said. But in 1959, 3 years later, Oswald got a minimum score to pass, which was marksman. You start out with a score of 190, and Oswald obtained a 191 out of 250 on that test. Also, numerous Marines who were with Oswald say that he was a very poor shot.
This is an interview with Sergeant Nelson Delgado, who served in the Marine Corps with Lee Harvey Oswald. Sergeant Delgado appeared as a witness before the Warren Commission. Was Oswald interested in guns?
They say he was a gun enthusiast, but I recall many instances where we stood inspections and he was constantly being gigged for having a dirty weapon and then taking improper care of his weapon. He was always reminded of when he had to clean the weapon, never took it upon himself to do so.
Do you have personal knowledge of Oswald's ability with a rifle?
At the range, he couldn't prove by me that he was a good shot. As any person who's ever served in the armed forces could tell you, there's a part in the qualification that calls for rapid firing. This is done with 10 shots, 8 in a clip and 2 that you load by hand. They give you maybe 30 or 45 seconds to be exact to fire these 10 rounds. Well, when you fire these, then you stand away from your firing position until everyone has finished firing. Then the targets are brought down and scored. The targets are run back up and they're dissed for the number that you have hit, 5s, 4s, 3s, or misses. Well, in Oswald's particular case, it was quite funny to look at because he would get a couple of discs. Maybe out of the possible 10, he'll get 2 or 3 Maggie's drawers. Now, these are a red flag that's on a long pole, and you don't see this on the firing line too often, not the Marine firing line. And it's you can't help but notice it when you're seeing discs, round cylinder things coming up and down. And farther on down the line, you see a flag waving. Well, that was going to catch your eye anyway. And we thought it was funny that Oswald was getting these Maggie's drawers so rapidly. And this is why I can't think that he could be a good shot, because a good shot doesn't pull this. He'll pull a 3, but he won't pull a Maggie's drawer. It's a complete miss.
Sherman Cooley, who was in the Marines with Oswald, said, quote, "If I had to pick one man in the whole United States to shoot me, I'd pick Lee Harvey Oswald. I saw the man shoot. There is no way he could have ever learned to shoot well enough to do what they accused him of doing in Dallas," end quote. Another military cohort of Oswald's was James Persons. Persons said Oswald had below average coordination, which he thought was a major factor in Oswald's very poor marksmanship. It's very convenient that Larry didn't report Oswald's score of 191, which was 1 point above the minimum. Once again, Larry is misleading his readers, and it comes across as an outright lie. While there's conflicting evidence here, it is absolutely not clear that Oswald was a good shooter. Larry then claims that Oswald practiced with a rifle. The only alleged time that Oswald ever practiced shooting the rifle was sometime in April of 63. Marina at that time said that he put the rifle under a raincoat on a night when it wasn't raining and went to Love Field Airport to practice. Yes, you heard correctly. Marina said that Oswald practiced shooting at the airport, and he took a rifle on a city bus under a raincoat. So that's what you'd have to believe, and even if you believe that, this was in April. There's no reported instance of Oswald going to the rifle range anytime closer to the shooting of President Kennedy, unless you disagree with the Warren report and you think that the rifle range sighting of Oswald, which there were a few sightings of Oswald or someone claiming to be Oswald at the range, but the Warren report said that these sightings could have not been him because it was documented that Oswald was hanging out with Marina and Ruth Payne at those alleged times or was at work. And I agree with the Warren Commission on that. There's just no truth whatsoever to the idea that Oswald had practiced with the rifle in the fall of 1963. The proof that he ever had rifle practice is sketchy to say the least. Oh, and by the way, Marina also said that after his rifle practice that night at the airport in April, Oswald buried his rifle in the field, even though there was no dirt found on the rifle when the FBI conducted microscopic analysis of it. So Oswald did not practice, and this is one of the reasons why even if he was a good shooter, it would have been very, very hard for him to accomplish what he's alleged to have done, because he didn't have any practice. So Lowry is once again shot down. Excuse the pun. Lowry then goes on to talk about Oswald's mail-order rifle, and there is a lot of evidence that points to Oswald owning a rifle, just maybe not the one used in the assassination. There are a few things that are definitely suspicious about the rifle order. So the rifle that shipped to Oswald, supposedly the one that we have in evidence, is 40 inches long. The rifle that Oswald ordered on the slip was 36 inches long. So they sent a different rifle than the one that Oswald supposedly ordered. No big deal, right? But this is where it gets really strange. Oswald allegedly mailed the money order and the order form from the rifle on March 12, 1963, and he mailed that from Dallas. But the money order was deposited in Chicago by Klein Sporting Goods on March 13th, the next day. Keep in mind, this is 1963. So 1 day is unreasonably fast for standard mail to travel from Dallas to Chicago, be received and processed by clients internally, and then have someone go deposit it at the bank. So we are to believe that all of this happened the next day. That would have been impossible. Also, no one ever saw Oswald pick up the rifle, or the pistol for that matter, and he never signed for either one. So we have this order form issue, but we also have things that don't add up, and of course Rich Lowry didn't mention those things. One important thing that Larry forgot to mention is that the Mamaka Carcano in evidence that Oswald was supposedly have owned does not match the Carcano rifle seen in the famous backyard photos of Oswald. So next, Lowry says, quote, "Of course, there's supposedly no way the magic bullet, the second shot, could have wounded two different men, JFK and his fellow passenger in the car, Governor Connally, in multiple places. In reality, that's what a bullet traveling in that direction would do, passing through Kennedy's neck and then through Connally's chest. As Vincent Bugliosi points out, it would have taken a real magic bullet to hit Kennedy in the neck and then disappear, not hitting Connally or embedding somewhere else in the car. Instead, it did what you'd expect of a bullet passing through the soft tissue of one man and then hitting the man sitting in front of him. This too has been confirmed by various studies and tests," end quote. Okay, so once again, Lowry didn't do his homework before he published this article for clickbait. When it comes to the magic bullet, there's really three different conversations. The first one is the trajectory and the entrance point. When you study the evidence, you'll find that the entry wound in Kennedy's back was too low to possibly have been an exit wound out of the front of Kennedy's neck. This is really the core problem with the Warren Report single bullet theory. How do we know this? Once again, this information is out there and easily confirmed with a simple search on the internet. We can look at the autopsy photos, our FBI's Seibert and O'Neill report. We can look at those holes in JFK's suit coat and his shirt. We can look at the death certificate. Come on, Lowry. The location of this wound is the whole key to the magic bullet theory, because it's either in his upper right back or it's close to the top of his neck, towards the right. Also, the back wound slash neck wound that hit Kennedy was specifically probed at the autopsy, and it did not go through. So again, just look at the evidence, and this is what you'll find. Lowry is wrong again. The next reason to doubt the magic bullet theory is the condition of the bullet itself, CE-399. There is no possible way that it could have gone through Kennedy's soft tissue, hit Connally's rib, wrist, and thigh, and then be in the condition that CE-399 is at. The reason we know this is because when tests were conducted, bullets that hit a human wrist and bullets that hit a goat cadaver were far more mangled and in worse shape than CE-399, which supposedly hit a rib, wrist, and thigh after going through Kennedy already. Also, I encourage anyone to go look at CE-399 online, and then look at the fragments that were taken from Governor Connally's body, which supposedly came from CE-399 bullet. And you tell me where on that bullet those fragments go. What you'll find is this. There's nowhere for them to go, because the fragments did not come from that bullet. This is very easy to look up and confirm, but obviously Larry did not do this simple exercise that a third grader could have done. Larry next says, quote, "There was no one on the famous grassy knoll. It was an unpropitious spot, not behind the motorcade where Oswald was, but in front of it for everyone to see. There is zero evidence, none, of additional shots. No bullets lodged in any cars or were found in the vicinity. No spent casing showed up on the grassy knoll itself. It's all made up," end quote. So Lowry says there's zero proof whatsoever of a shot from the grassy knoll. Wrong again, Lowry. There is some proof. There are witnesses who saw someone behind the picket fence on the grassy knoll fire a rifle. You can hear details of that in episode 7 of this podcast. There is a jarring report that there potentially was a Secret Service agent on the grassy knoll. So there's evidence that a man who identified himself as a Secret Service agent was on top of the grassy knoll telling people to clear the area right after the shots were fired. Listen to episode 6 to hear more details. Officer Joe Smith and Deputy Constable Seymour Weissman both saw this man, and he showed them Secret Service ID. But the Secret Service said that there was no one who wasn't with the motorcade, and the Secret Service said they didn't have anyone stationed on the grassy knoll. So this man was impersonating Secret Service agents and trying to keep people away from the grassy knoll area, especially behind the picket fence area. Who was this man, and what role did he play in the assassination? Again, this man was seen by numerous people, including two police officers. This remains one of the biggest mysteries of the case today. Also, Larry, there's more evidence. Three railroad workers, S.M. Holland, Richard Dodd, and Leon Simmons, were on the nearby railroad bridge overpass overlooking the entire plaza and ran over to behind the picket fence on the grassy knoll when they saw a puff of smoke come out from underneath the trees around the time the shots were fired. Lee Bowers, who I detailed in episode 7 of this podcast, had a great view of the entire scene. He was in a railroad tower behind the picket fence. He says that he saw two men standing behind the fence at the top of the grassy knoll, and he saw a flash of light at the time of the shooting. Also, there's Ed Hoffman, who became a good friend of mine during all my years of research. Ed was a deaf mute who says he saw a shooter fire a shot from behind the picket fence on top of the knoll. The man then tossed the gun to a man in work clothes, who broke the gun down by twisting it, put it in a bag, and walked down the railroad tracks. None of these witnesses individually establishes that there was someone on the grassy knoll, but when you combine all of their testimony, you absolutely have to leave the door open for it. To say that there's zero proof is not factually true given everything that I just said. Please go back and listen to episodes 6, 7, and 8 to hear these witnesses' accounts in more detail. And these facts are arrived at years and years of research, not just picking up a book by someone who agrees totally with the Warren Commission's findings, like Larry did. Plus, these witness statements are readily available and can be found on the internet by anyone. Oh yeah, Mr. Larry, we also have medical evidence of a shot from the front, which would mean that there was someone on the grassy knoll shooting at Kennedy. We looked and studied the witness statements from doctors, nurses, and medical personnel in Dallas for our conclusions. We did not take the word of one man who is the apple of the eye of the national media. So what is that medical evidence from Parkland Hospital? Well, 8 doctors and a nurse in Dallas said that the neck wound was an entrance wound, which would mean the shot would have come from the front. 8 doctors in Dallas, including Kemp Clark, the chief of neurosurgery, said that they could see the cerebellum in JFK's head wound. So if that's true, it would mean that the wound was too low to have come from the back, and it would be consistent with a large hole in the rear of the president's head. The earliest statements of 43 doctors, nurses, and medical professionals who saw JFK's body in Dallas and in Bethesda was that there was a large wound in the right rear of his head, which demonstrates a shot from the front. The written medical report from Dallas says that the head wound was in the right occipital area, which is the lower back part of the head, which would mean a shot from the front. Tom Robinson, the mortician who prepared Kennedy's body for burial, says that he saw a small hole in the right temple. This hole was allegedly seen by autopsy photographer Robert Kutzen and Lieutenant Commander William Pitzer, who worked on film at the Bethesda Medical Center. So there you have it, Mr. Larry. That's kind of a lot of medical evidence, not zero evidence, showing that there was a shot from the front. Larry then continues on with his article. He says, quote, Oswald was caught dead to right. The murder weapon was his, and it was found where he worked and where people saw and heard a gunman, end quote. Okay, so this idea that the murder weapon was Oswald's, well, we've already talked about the mail order. One big question on the murder weapon is, was it a Mammoth or Carcano, or was it a Mauser? And if it was a Carcano, why did everyone that found the rifle say it was a Mauser at first?
They pulled the rifle out and handed it to Captain Fritz, who held it up by the, had a strap on it. He held it up by the strap and asked if anyone knew what kind of rifle it was. Well, by this time, Deputy Constable Seymour Weitzman had joined us. Weitzman was a gun buff. He had a sporting goods store at one time, and he was very good at with weapons. And he said, it looks like a Mauser, and he walked over to Fritz, and Captain Fritz was holding the rifle up in the air, and I was standing next to Weitzman, who was standing next to Fritz, and we weren't any more than 6 or 8 inches from the rifle, and stamped right on the barrel of the rifle was 7.65 Mauser. And that's when Weitzman said it is a Mauser and pointed to the 7.65 Mauser stamp on the barrel.
It turns out this whole conversation about the Mauser wasn't a simple misunderstanding. It couldn't have been, and here's why. 3 police officers who were there on the 6th floor when the rifle was discovered, Boone, Craig, and Weitzman, all said that it was a Mauser. Weitzman owned a sporting goods store along with being a police officer, and he was a gun buff. All three gave sworn affidavits later that same day and continued to say that it was a Mauser, when supposedly there was some confusion, but they got it all cleared up right away, right? Well, not really.
The Dallas Sheriff's Department said a rifle had been found on a staircase on the fifth floor of the building near the scene where it is now believed from where the shots were fired. It was a 7.65 Mauser, a German rifle.
A German built Mauser with the sniper scope that was used to kill President Kennedy.
A Mauser has been found, a 7.65 Mauser.
It's a 7.65 Mauser.
It was a 7.65 Mauser.
A 7.65 Mauser.
A 7.65 Mauser.
The problem is they're still saying it's a Mauser, and their affidavits say that. We have a Carcano in evidence today, but where did the Mauser go? There's something going on with the Mauser, probably more than just a simple misunderstanding. Back to Lowry's article. He then says, quote, Oswald was obviously a desperate man. He killed a cop as he tried to get away, and he was fighting the cops when they found him hiding in a movie theater, end quote. So let's take a look at this statement from Lowry. This idea that Oswald killed a cop as he was trying to get away, well, that's just not true. So we can debate about whether or not Oswald killed J.D. Tippit. This is a murky area that has a lot of conflicting details and points to consider on both sides of the argument. However, this notion that Oswald killed Tippit as part of his getaway is not consistent with the witness testimony. Helen Markham, who was one of the key witnesses, said that the man who killed Tippit was not being chased. Instead, Tippit was driving behind this man in the street, and the man was on a sidewalk when Tippit stopped his patrol car. When the car stopped, the man turned back to Tippit.
This man was walking along the sidewalk on 10th Street. This police car was driving very slow down 10th Street. Well, the man kept walking, and this police car kept coming on and coming on, and finally he stopped, and the man stopped. And whether the policeman say, come over to the car, talk to him, I don't know, but he went.
Was he on the driver's side or on the other side?
On the other side.
And did he stick his head in the window?
Yes, sir. He folded his hands like this. He put them in through the window, up on the window, and he leaned over like this.
What do you remember about this man? Was he a big man or a small man? Or what?
No, he wasn't a very big man. He was short, kind of short, as far as I remember.
So let's say Oswald is this man. He turns around and comes back to the car. And what's he do? He puts his arms on the passenger door of the car and leans in the vent window and starts talking with Tippit. Now, is that the way that someone acts when they are trying to get away from the police? If he wanted to run away and he's already in front of the cop, would he turn around and go back to the cop? That doesn't make any sense at all. Also, if your answer to this question is yes, he wanted to turn around and go back to the cop and kill the cop to make sure he couldn't get him. Okay, if that's your position, why is he in a leisurely manner putting his arms on the passenger side of the car door like he knows Tippit? That does not make any sense. And it's not the behavior of someone who's trying to get away from the police. Oh, and by the way, they checked for fingerprints where the man came back and put his arms over the passenger seat window of the Tippit's car. And Oswald's fingerprints were not found. This area of the case is cloudy and very complex. The conversation about whether or not Oswald killed Tippit. But it is not complex at all that Oswald was trying to get away. That's just not what the evidence shows. So you know, we need to get the little details right to have a chance at figuring out what actually happened, instead of just picking propaganda on the side that we decided we wanted to cheer for. That's just not how it works if we're trying to find out the actual truth of what really happened. Lowry's extensive article goes on to say, quote, Oswald fit the profile of someone who would be an assassin, and sure enough, before he killed JFK, all the evidence suggests that he tried to shoot and kill the right-wing figure, General Edwin Walker. Okay, so now let's talk about this. All the evidence shows that he tried to kill General Edwin Walker. There's some pretty good reasons to believe that Oswald did not shoot at General Walker. The bullet that hit Walker's wall was from a steel-jacketed .30-06, then all of a sudden changed to a copper-jacketed 6.5mm bullet after the Kennedy assassination. The house was scoped out by multiple people in advance of the Walker shooting who drove cars. Oswald is alleged to have been alone, and he did not drive a car. On the night when the shot was fired, there were witnesses that saw a car fleeing the scene and two people were seen driving away. The most important thing about the Walker allegation is that Oswald wasn't even a suspect in the Walker shooting until after the JFK assassination. General Walker had made tons of enemies, and I'm sure that there were a lot of people that wanted him dead for his outspoken beliefs. Lowry's article goes on to say, quote, "Why, if the CIA is omnicompetent enough to pull off such an operation, did it not deploy a sniper who could get in and out of Dallas with no issue? At the very least, it should have secured some sort of getaway vehicle or plan for Oswald. Instead, it allowed him only to narrowly escape the depository as a matter of sheer luck, and then to wander through the streets of Dallas a clearly desperate man. Then it permitted him to be interrogated by the police for days, when he could have unraveled the entire plot instead of acting like a guilty as hell lone gunman," end quote. This argument by Lowry really misstates and misunderstands what the conspiracy argument is. You know, I don't know if Lowry is someone who has read any other books aside from Posner and Bugliosi's, but if he has read any other conspiracy slash critic leaning books, he would know that there's no one who believes that Oswald was a CIA assassin. So, Mr. Lowry, you're successfully defeating an argument that no one believes. No one thinks Oswald was hired as a CIA assassin. The argument is that he was a CIA asset who was used to infiltrate leftist groups. This becomes clear when you look at Oswald's time in New Orleans in the summer of 1963. He's working for an FBI agent, Guy Bannister, handing out flyers for the Fair Play for Cuba committee. Some of these materials are stamped with Guy Bannister's office. If you study and research the case, instead of reading a Warren Commission book or two, you'll find that there is an Oswald connection, and it's not as a secret double agent assassin. Oh, and by the way, there are dozens of documented instances of Oswald being impersonated. So why would you impersonate somebody if he's just a regular person? Again, why would someone impersonate someone who's just a regular person? I mean, it's more than a coincidence. There is a lot of evidence to support this claim. I cover a lot of it in my book, and you can go back and listen to episode 10 of this podcast, where I cover some of the Oswald impersonation material. Suffice it to say, Oswald was being impersonated many times, and it doesn't make sense for impersonations to be happening on that scale unless there's something else going on. Finally, Lowry has this to say about Jack Ruby. Quote, "His murderous act was an extremely near-run thing. He had agreed to wire one of his strippers $25. He went to a Western Union a block from police headquarters. He didn't strike the clerk as being in any particular hurry. As it turned out, a transfer of Oswald from the police to the county jail had been delayed earlier that morning. Ruby had assumed it had already happened, but a final minutes long delay, Oswald wanted to change clothes, meant that Oswald was in the basement just as Ruby arrived. If it had been 3 seconds later, I would have missed this person," Ruby noted later, end quote. So Lowry gives the Warren Report position, which is that Ruby just happened to spur of the moment decide to kill Oswald. It wasn't planned out, and it was just done at the last second. By the way, the evidence for that is this whole Western Union conversation. How could he possibly have planned to kill Oswald if he was getting a Western Union transfer done at that time? He couldn't have possibly killed Oswald because he was getting the transfer done. So this is the argument. Well, Ruby relies on being at Western Union to show that killing Oswald was a spur-of-the-moment decision. But the problem is that Jack Ruby set up the Western Union payment in advance the night before with his dancer Karen Carlin. It was Ruby's ideal. She didn't need the money. She had rent due, but the landlord was soft with the payment, so he didn't really care when it would be. And by the way, her paycheck was the next day. She was about to get paid anyway. She didn't need this money. Ruby spoke to her in advance about it. That's what Karen Carlin herself said. Ruby was visited by Dr. Jolene West while he was in prison. This is the same doctor who was a subcontractor for the CIA's MKUltra program. Probably the biggest reason to be suspicious of Ruby being involved somehow is the quote that he gives where he says that everything pertaining to what's happening will never come to the surface because of powerful people. He basically says that there's this big conspiracy, and you know, it's not what it seems it is.
People have so much to gain and have such a material motive for putting in a position on him. We'll never let the true facts come above voice to the world.
Part Part of that interview is really hard to understand, so here's what Ruby says. Ruby states, quote, "Everything pertaining to what's happening has never come to the surface. The world will never know the true facts of what occurred and my motives. The people who had so much to gain and had such an ulterior motive for putting me in the position I'm in will never let the true facts come above board to the world." A reporter then asks, "Are these people in very high positions, Jack?" And Ruby responds, "Yes," end quote. All of these points that I've made today are just counterpoints to Rich Lowry's piece. I will say this. Lowry has not spent hundreds and hundreds of hours looking into the eyes of a lot of these witnesses like I have over the last 35 years. He has not spent weeks at a time at the Dallas Municipal Archives or dug through literally mountains of files trying to find answers as to what happened to President Kennedy. I think that when you look at some of this information that we have spoken about today, you'll find that the case is far more interesting than Lowry says it is, far more confusing, and you'll likely come to the conclusion that Lee Harvey Oswald did not act alone, if he acted at all, to kill President Kennedy. If you like what you hear every week and want to learn more about the assassination, please pick up my book, The End of Innocence, The Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's available right now on Amazon, and it's on sale. Or you can find it at www.endofinnocencejfk.com. And hey, send me your comments about the book or this podcast at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com. We'll see you next week.